Come. It is time to keep your appointment with the Wicker Man.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 10 of the Wicker Man podcast, where every week me and a different guest go through the 1973 cult classic The Wicker Man, different scenes at a time. I am joined in this week's episode by Davern. Davern, how are you doing?
Hello. Thank you very much for having me on the show to talk about this classic horror movie. I mean, it is labeled as a horror movie, right?
Yeah, a horror, mystery, musical.
Yes, it is everything. I almost can like imagine the people that went into this movie cold and have no idea what to expect because it goes through many different genres.
Yeah, so we're now in episode 10 of the podcast, and following on from the previous episode, we get Harry returning to Lord Summerisle's manor, where he finds Lord Summerisle and the schoolteacher Miss Rose singing the song "The Tinker of Rye," and then throwing what he discovered in Rowan's grave at them, a March Hare, and then brings in the discussion over what happened with Rowan, especially whether or not she's alive, whether she was murdered, and how he's saying that he was going to go back to the mainland to bring in the force of the Highland Police. And the scene ends with Howie going back to the chemists, breaking into the shop and going through the records of the photographs that they have and finding out that the harvest of 1972 failed when Rome was the symbol of the May Day celebrations, and him started to discover that Rowan may still be alive and is maybe intended to be a sacrifice to make up for the crops failing the previous year in order to get the crops to grow in that year. So before we start going into this scene in particular, what's your history with The Wicker Man?
Okay, so I know I have seen this movie when I was younger. I know I rented it because it was in the horror section. And I remember when I first watched it, I didn't much like it when I first saw it. You have to remember I was about probably around the age of 12, 13, and I was expecting something really like gory, but then I saw this
more like Hammer.
Yeah, like, you know, I saw this cop come in this area and a bunch of like seeing a bunch of things happening, people having sex. I'm thinking, is this a sex comedy? And then there was an earlier scene that I really wanted to talk about because it was my favorite, is with Britt Eklund. She's sitting in the sauna, she's naked and just dancing around. That is like the best moment of the movie, and I was like, Please, Cooch, please, Tony, let me just talk about this one scene. But no, that's all right. I will listen to the episode. But yeah, and so seeing him try to find the disappearance about this girl, she may be murdered, and it looks like the people in this town may or may not be involved with it, but there's just some strange things going on. And I know that this movie was a heavily influencer of like Midsommar, and yeah, so, and then as things progress, things just start to get a little bit more crazy, and when our detective, played by Robin Hardy, right? Is that the
Edward Woodward.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Edward Woodward. I'm sorry. The director is Robin Hardy.
Yeah.
Okay, my bad. Edward Woodward starts to get the grave exonerated, and it took like forever to get that done because people are like, well, you gotta make sure you talk to the high priestess and you gotta get this permission from there. And he's like, I don't need the authority because I'm a cop from the mainland. And everyone there is like, well, you don't have jurisdiction here to do that. Finally, he does get the jurisdiction from Christopher Lee's character, and he exonerates the grave, finds out that there's a bunny. Which is weird because that goes back to an earlier scene of the little girl drawing the hair, and he discovers a hair in there. Look, I know it's called a hair, folks, but I'm calling it a rabbit or a bunny, so if I offend any of you without calling it the right thing, I apologize. Please do not send me any invites to this festival island. Just saying that off camera right there. But yeah, he exonerates the grave, sees the rabbit, the hair, throws it down. Now, I believe, now in this section right there, it's Christopher Lee. And is that Ingrid Pitt as the teacher librarian?
No, Ingrid Pitt's appearance is slightly earlier on in the film. And then a bit later on, this is Diane Salento, if I pronounced her name right, as the teacher, Miss Rose.
Okay, because I swear, I don't know why, it looks just kind of similar. And I saw Ingrid Pitt's name in the credits, so okay. Oh, she was married to Sean Connery? I did not know that. Oh, and she, of course, was married to the author of The Wicker Man, Anthony Schaffer. Okay, all right. Oh, very cool. But I digress. He's in there, and they're singing a song. And I got to say, I love the songs in this,
yeah.
But I don't understand most of the lyrics. I should have watched it with subtitles again, but I didn't because I think I had a roommate that wanted to watch it. And so, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing, something I actually mentioned, talk about it, is you mentioned the scene with Brooke Eklund, the dance. Now, did you say you watched that when you first watched, you watched that earlier in the film? It was before this scene.
Well, yes.
Well, that's such a thing because I'm going to get more into in the next episode. I've also mentioned throughout this podcast, the version of the film that I'm covering is the final cut. But,
oh.
And the final cut has that scene take place after this one.
Really?
It's the theatrical cut has it earlier on.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. Fair enough. Okay. Sorry about that, folks. Yeah. This was streaming on Shudder, so I watched the version that was on there, which I guess was the theatrical cut. I had no idea that there were different cuts of this movie.
So, yeah, there are currently three different publicly available cuts. So,
there's three different cuts of this?
Yeah, it's the Blade Runner of 70s horror.
Really? Oh, damn.
And
so
again,
are you going to do like a different minute-by-minute podcast of like this cut, and then go back and do the theatrical cut, and then the final cut, and then the European cut, and then the made-for-TV version?
Yeah, I mean, it's as I've mentioned before, and I mentioned again in this podcast, so there's been three publicly available cuts, and there's rumors of over different cuts, some shorter, some longer. There's been some that Roger Corman was involved with when it was originally intended for release in America. And seen recently at some recording studio, Canal have announced they're doing a 4K restoration of The Wicker Man. But I don't think they've announced which cut they're going to be doing the restoration of, whether it's just will be one of them or whether they're doing all three of the publicly available ones. And so, yeah, that's something that'll be interesting to see. And also interesting in just this one, how you feel. I know you've not seen the final cut, but what would you think of it with that scene with Brett Eklund's Willow taking place after this one rather than earlier on in the film?
Yeah, that's interesting because in the context of the final cut, noted because in the theatrical version, that sequence happens when the cop first comes into town and he checks into the hotel, and it's after he sees like the orgy sequence that happens outside, and it looks like they are seducing him to maybe be a part of this extravaganza. To like, you know, but now seeing that scene in the context of this version, maybe the seduction is used to sort of like lure him to be the, I don't know, am I giving spoilers away in this?
Go podcast? Ahead.
Okay, they're sort of luring him to be the Wicker Man.
Yeah.
By having her do that dance. It's a way to sort of like use the sexuality to sort of like drug him. Or it's also as a way to lure him more into finding more about the case and about the sacrifice of Rowan.
Yeah, and also kind of throw him off guard a bit, kind of take his defenses down.
And this whole movie, they are basically just teasing and ridiculing his beliefs because he's a strong Christian and has very strong Christian beliefs. And they are, I guess the people in this town are pagan. It looks like they respect Christians, but they have their own belief structures and they are just not in with what he's saying. And they find it to be kind of Jose and passive and a lot of things that they believe. He thinks that they're all heretics and mongrels. They're not. They seem to be like a very peaceful tribe right there. I mean, I probably would have gone along with it too, because I mean, hell, sexy ladies right there dancing in my rooms. And yeah, I'd be like, okay, I would probably be dead. Yes. 100%. Brett Eklund right there just saying, come on, come to me and let me ease you. I'm like, okay, I'm a dead man. All right, fair enough.
Yeah, I mean, and then also we've mentioned like talks about sex. I mean, let's start with going into this scene in particular, and I think let's start with the song that Christopher Lee and Dan Sands will perform here, "The Tinker of Rye," which is another great piece of work by Paul Giovanni here. And I think it's the only time we actually properly hear Christopher Lee sing in this film. It's brilliant baritone voice and works as a nice contrast to the more lighter voice of Diane Salento. And, I mean, you mentioned not really quite being able to understand the lyrics. Something that's helpful to understand about pretty much every song in The Wicker Man, they're all about sex.
Oh, okay. That made sense. Okay.
Yeah, it's all like yes. All metaphors. Like in this one, The Tinker of Rye, it uses the metaphor of mending a kettle to represent sex. So it's all about plugging holes and nailing and things. And you actually properly pay attention to the lyrics and that take them all in. It's pretty obviously about sex.
Oh, I've noticed a lot of the songs that are before this one were also about growing the crops and harvesting, and that also was kind of a metaphor for sex as well. There's a song that the children are singing there's a guy singing with kids.
Yeah, and the maple dance.
Yeah, the maple dance. That is also has to be about procreation, I'm pretty sure, in a way.
Yes, their life cycle, what they view as their sort of life, death, and rebirth on the island.
Yeah, all right there. That's good to know that they're talking about sex right there, and I'm pretty sure they're just kind of put it in his face. Do you believe that he actually is? I want to ask you about this too. Do you believe that he actually is a virgin, the top character?
Yeah, I do. This is another thing that's actually in the different cuts. So in the director's cuts. It's different to final cuts. There's a full prologue right at the start of the film with Howie on the Scottish mainland, and it goes into a bit more detail about Howie's life in mainland Scotland, and makes it more pretty explicit that Howie is a virgin and he's waiting until marriage. And we get little bits of that through the other scenes in the film, like after Willow's dance and saying that he's wanted to wait until marriage. And so, yeah, I mean, in this instance, it's something I don't really see why he'd lie about it, and also a pretty key reason for why they'd want to sacrifice him at the end.
Okay, all right. Because it seems to be that he's, you know, very kind of like, not only is he like a virgin, he also seems to be very sexually repressed. I mean, he's a guy that would feel ashamed even for masturbating.
I get that. He's that very uptight, proper, that's the right way to describe it, puritanical Christian.
Yeah, the guy that goes by the books of everything, he follows the law to the degree, doesn't even question anything. He doesn't even like question religion or even horrible things that happened in religious names, because there probably was horrible things that happened in the past using the Christian faith for things. He probably doesn't even question that, but he's going to question this group and their religious activities and so on. He has issues with, like, you know, children kind of run around in, like, these skin-tight suits and everything, and because he probably sees that as being, like, you know, a sexual thing. But this tribe doesn't see sex as being, like, a bad thing. The nudity and nakedness is not a bad thing, and they try to have their tribe express their sexuality in what they feel is a very healthy and safe way. They are not exploiting anyone, but through his eyes, he thinks that they are exploiting people, and it kind of plays on that notion of the audience, because he's like our audience protagonist. Yeah. So you're supposed to like kind of like agree with everything that he sees, like, you know, oh my gosh, these people are weird, they're wearing masks, and they may have actually killed a child, they're doing these bad things, but they don't really see it that way. So it's kind of an interesting contradiction of ideas.
Yeah, it's an interesting part of it, because of this is like one of the key like themes of film, and of part of the free loving naturalist vibe of the version of Summer Island versus the repression of Howie. Yeah, I mean, you can see with how uptight proper he is. In fact, that's pretty much every scene in the film. He's wearing the full police uniform.
Good point. I didn't think about that too. Yeah, he never takes that thing off because he has to show his authority-ness of everything. And I like the scene of him coming in there and throwing the hair down. And neither Christopher Lee's character or Diane Cilantro, they don't even bat an eye. Everything he said, like, this is sacrilegious. And she's like, only if the body was consecrated on Christian ground. But this is our faith, and so it's not sacrilegious at all. And he says, I'm going to go to the mainland. The cop guy says, I'm going to go to the mainland, and we're going to report you. And they're like, sure, you know, that's fine. You do what you Gotta do. We get into this part where he does break in and he sees the pictures of Roland and finds out the crops are dying. And there's a key moment where Christopher Lee's character goes, well, it's probably good that you leave because we don't want you to be offended by the stuff that happens during our May Day festival presentation. And then he just includes that, oh, well, Roland actually may still be alive because he never actually did find a death certificate.
Yes, yeah, they made it a big point that it's not find a death certificate. And again, you see here, there's no actual body. It's all part of the mystery that's presented throughout the film of, well, starting whether or not Roman actually exists or not, and then whether or not she's still alive. And in this is a bit where we get more of the confirmation, well, not really confirmation, but how he gets the idea that she's still alive, and he's thinking that this is intended to be the sacrifice to make up for the previous year's crop failure. And this is also like the first bit where we get full confirmation of the crops having failed. Like, we get little hints earlier in the film that something isn't right with the crops. So, like, with Howie's meal in the Green Man pub pretty much all being out of tins, the Ingrid Pitt's librarian in the records office having like soup from a can. It's all like some little things and what specific things, but it gives the idea that something happened with the crops. And especially after we see earlier on in the film that the picture of the previous year's harvest wasn't on the wall in Green Man. And here we see the reason why it's pretty much empty. There's virtually no crops there.
I also figured too that even earlier on in the movie when he's trying to ask people about where this girl was and no one seems to have any recollection of it. Not even her mom, or not even the mom has any recollection about where this girl is. She's saying that, oh, she's dead. And it was at that moment when I was watching it again, I'm thinking, something's not right, buddy. You should probably get out of there right now because no one's really helping you out much there. I know that you feel that you have authority here because you're a cop, but no one here is afraid of cops. They don't even care at all that you're a cop and you're just one guy. You should probably get what you can right now, especially when he found there's no death certificate. Probably should have been like, all right, I should get out of here. Even earlier that, even when he was at the school and talking to everyone there, he finally, after that, he finally had the gravestone and he made, you know, a cross with the woods right there. He probably should have just gone away and had the other cops come in there to investigate because something didn't seem right. Even after he found the hair, I probably would have gotten out of there right away. I wouldn't even gone to the school to confront anything. I would be like, huh, they're hiding something. I'm not going to get much help from anyone here in town. I'm the only person here that doesn't believe in this stuff. I got to get out of here. I got to get on a plane right away. I got to call someone. I'm pretty sure they had phones there, right? There was phones you could call the mainland, right? Am I right about that? I'm pretty sure they could. So he should have done something more right away, but he did not because he has to feel like he is in control. He is our main protagonist, so he's going to help save this girl. He's like sort of like John Wayne and the Searchers. And then he finds out that secrets about the Indian tribe that he shouldn't find out at all. So it felt like that.
Yeah, it feels like he's like kind of stymied by his own moral code. Like, he feels like he has to be in control, in charge of everything, and that his righteousness that feels will protect him and gives him the belief that he's doing what's right.
And in a way, too, I mean, be the fact that he has not successfully has had sex with a woman, he's feeling very emasculated. And so I'm sure that he's doing this thing to feel righteous, like, hey, I saved a little girl. That's going to get me good with the ladies because they're going to think I'm a good father type because I was able to save this little girl. I can't have any kids of my own, but I'm going to save this other girl.
Yeah, kind of, interesting way to think of it.
Yeah, it's like this whole religious upbringing is to be like, you got to be a nice girl, you got to fall in love and get married and everything. And if you don't do that, you're going to burn the hellfire of eternity. If you kiss another girl right now before marriage, you're going to burn the hellfire of eternity. You're going to sin.
Yeah, you can imagine how he's experienced quite a lot of like fire and brimstone speeches in churches when he was growing up.
Oh, very much so. And I'm pretty sure he like probably looked at a Sears catalog, saw like the naked ladies in there, and he just went to a little private time, and his mom's like, hey there, you're going to be a cop soon. Don't be doing that dirty thing right there, you dirty person. How dare you just do this nasty thing in the Lord's house, no less. That's before they had Victoria's Secret catalog, folks. All right, back in the day, before Victoria's Secret catalog, the Sears catalog was just, oh, hot ladies there. That's all I had, all right? You understand this, folks? Before the internet, we didn't have much for porn, all right? True, there was Playboys, but you actually had to go out to find that stuff, all right? The Sears catalog came to your house every week, all right? It was a lonely time, all right, when I was 13, so don't look at me, all right? Don't judge me.
So, going back to the command, it's... I also kind of interesting, like, in this bit as well, so we get Howie throwing the hair and doing this whole big explanation of everything. It's how, like, he has the more anger and fury in the way he's speaking, whilst Christopher Lee, he's the more calm, genial. He's still keeping up the appearance of him being, like, this more genial, folksy figure, a respected figure in the community. Like, it's kind of the way they've played on Christopher Lee's image at the time by, like, kind of going against the darker, more overtly villainous characters that Lee was known for from the Hammer films. So having him play this more genial character here, but it's Christopher Lee, so there's not, especially at that time, you're probably thinking there's something that's being hidden here, and yeah. it feels too, like, genial, like he's playing things along for Howie, and the way he's doing it is trying to make Howie suspicious.
I only recognized Chris when I first watched this movie. I recognized Christopher Lee from Star Wars, so I know that when I watched him in this, and he's all very nice, I'm still thinking in the back of my mind, yeah, something doesn't seem to be quite right. He's a little bit too cheerful and nice, and just something just seems... I gotta keep my eye on you. Something doesn't seem quite right. And that's why I really kind of thought that it was Ingrid Pitt in this, because I know Ingrid Pitt has been appearing in a bunch of, like, Hammer movies. I'm like, oh, that'd be so cool. They were both in that scene together. So, sorry, blonde hair ladies. I recognize the other lady, Britt Eklund. So you can't do this to me. You can't have two good-looking blonde ladies, Britt Eklund and Ingrid Pitt and Diane Cilento. That's the name doesn't seem right, but that's her. Okay, all right. I just thought that going back to Christopher Lee, just being Star Wars and seeing him in this, just felt a little bit off. Because I didn't see any of the Hammer horror movies until much later with him as Dracula.
That's well, like, my first real exposure to Christopher Lee was through the Lord of the Rings series.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, Sauron, right?
Yeah, Saruman, yeah.
Saruman. All right, yes. So, yeah, so every time he plays a role, he always plays, like, this bad guys in roles. So he just got kind of typecast, and I felt kind of bad for the guy. He should have been, you know, in a children's fable playing a friendly old – he should have played Geppetto in Pinocchio. Yeah. That would be good. He could have played the nice little dad to Belle in Beauty and the Beast. That would have been good.
I mean, if he was playing Geppetto, he could have been, like, doing really well in, like, the Del Toro version.
Oh, yeah. That would have been excellent. Yeah.
You can see why he's got that typecast as a villainous role, especially that brilliant voice he has, that deep, booming baritone that works so well for villains.
And you said the song was done by Paul Giovanni.
Yeah.
You know what? You know, when I was watching the credit for this, I'm like, Paul Giovanni. Why is that name? I'm thinking of Paul Giamatti. Okay. That's my bad. I'm like, Paul Giovanni, has he been in other things? I'm pretty sure he has been, but I'm thinking about the actor Paul Giamatti from Sideways and Private Parts and other things. But Paul Giovanni, I believe he's only just done, he did the music for The Wicker Man, and they did a thing called Christopher of Blood. That's really it. He hasn't really done...
Yeah, this is the thing that he's most well known for, and the soundtrack is did for this. And it's also interesting, like, with the music as well, like, as I've got the soundtrack for The Wicker Man, both on CD and on vinyl.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
Yeah, and it's also interesting hearing the version of The Tinker of Rye on those, because there's a little bit of an extra verse and bits of laughing from Christopher Lee and Diane Cilento. And, like, in this scene in particular, it was recorded live, and then they did one in the studio for the soundtracks.
Is it the same actors?
Yeah.
It is. Okay. Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, it's the one where, like, and going back to the whole thing about the song being about sex, the way you hear the two perform that song, they clearly know it's about sex and they're having fun with it. And yeah, it essentially plays with the way they look at each other and their interactions physically in this scene.
So I do want to ask you, too, because I kind of want to bring up a little bit about the remake. With Nicolas Cage, is that sequence in the remake where he finds a hair and brings it to the island? I don't know.
In the remake, it's more, if I remember right, that's the way he finds the burnt doll and the That how to get burned bit.
Oh, that's the... Oh, my gosh. Okay. Oh, that's hilarious. Oh, because I do know I first heard about... I know I've seen The Wicker Man when I was, like, a little kid, but then I've seen trailers for the remake. And I remember specifically about the remake is that it was directed by Neil LaBute, who directed some of my favorite movies. I'm like, oh, he's going to remake The Wicker Man. Okay, that should be interesting. And it was very interesting, and that's all I'm going to say. I'm going to shut the door on that. I'm sorry to bring that up there. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, very interesting. Not in the way I think they intended.
No, not at all. It was funny. It was fun. Yeah. I laughed a lot watching it, but I know that I was not supposed to laugh watching it. But I just like Nicolas Cage just in a bear suit punching people. That's just my favorite. Yeah. Sorry. I'm sorry. It's a funny movie. All right, I'll shut up now.
Yeah, I mean, somewhere, all, like, if it's laughing the original, feeling it's all intentional, the remake, it all feels like they intended to be fully, completely straight-faced serious and didn't intend it to be as funny as it was.
Yeah, no, I mean, but even watching the original this time, I mean, it's odd because I'm going through this movie from the cop's perspective, but yet I'm sort of like siding with the other people are saying as well. And in the sequence that we're discussing, they have the absolute right to kind of like bury things the way they see fit. And they talk about, you know, all of the people who die are part of the nature of the trees, and how they decide to dispose of the bodies are their own beliefs. So they could, maybe she did die, and they put her body in the ground to make the crops grow. I don't know for sure. Did they sacrifice her? I don't know, but yeah.
And that's what they want you to think. It's that old big question of, is happens it only really until we actually see Rowan in person right at the end that we actually find out what's happening, and even then it does the old big twist at the end. And it's kind of what helps make this work so well, is it does play as a really engaging mystery.
And even if you kind of like, even if someone knows what happens at the end, because it's on the box, all right? Yeah. I remember when I first saw the movie, I mean, the box shows the Wicker Man. And even on the back cover of it, though, it shows Edward Woodward character kind of inside of it. So I know the ending, but even though I know the ending, it was still kind of fascinating to see how it progressed to that.
Yeah, it's always interesting. It's like kind of like the Planet of the Apes thing, where that final image and final twist of the film is so iconic and it's become so associated with filming on the different covers of the different releases of the film, and you'd figure out know what that ending is, but it's still an engaging journey getting up to that point.
And I kind of wish that they did more series of this. Like, there are more Children of the Corn movies, and I think if they had a whole series of Wicker Man movies, it would be a lot more interesting, because there are so many characters in this you could expand on from.
Because and I'm going to talk about it more in the final episode, but there were plans for a while to make a sequel to The Wicker Man, like about 20, 30 years later. And then we got the spiritual successor, The Wicker Tree, a few years ago. Aside from really the remake was probably the only thing that's been but got pretty high profile thing from the film since the original was released. As I've mentioned before, you can see the roots of the Wicker Man going into like modern day folk horror, but it's kind of, for me, I kind of feel that it's this one and done. It's kind of like rob the film a bit of the impact of the ending actually showing what happens to the island afterwards.
Yes, you know, that's kind of a good point, because everything's kind of like one and done with, I guess. I don't know. I just worry that HBO Max is going to take this and turn it to a series like they're doing with It, and try to make a prequel what happens to the town before Pennywise comes in there. I have a feeling they're going to do a series to show you how Christopher Lee's character got into power, and be a whole series about that. And it ends with a cop coming to town. It just like, I worry about shit like that.
I think definitely since like success of stuff like Midsommar, you can imagine that there'll be some conversations from some people wanting to capitalize on the explosion of folk horror, try to do something with the Wicker Man. But I'm guessing the lingering memories of the 2006 version are still in the minds of executives. They don't want the Tories failure like that one.
Yeah. Although I think now with Nicolas Cage getting kind of a resurgence and, you know, being a good actor, well, he always was, if you actually did give it a good script, and I imagine if someone like Ari Aster did do a remake, well, he already made Midsommar, but if he actually did do a remake of The Wicker Man with Nick Cage, Ari Aster style, released by A24, it might be a different type of movie. I just think they had a wrong director doing that, which is weird. All the director's earlier film was Neil Abute, who did Your Friends and Neighbors and In the Company of Men. There's Betty. I thought he had a good track record so far, and then just kind of went downhill. But that's neither here nor there. I know what I need to do. I need to rewatch. I need to buy The Wicker Man. Now, does The Wicker Man have like a 3-disc set with like all 3 cuts of the movie?
So, yeah, there was a, like, the version that I got when the final cut was released, well, it's a 4-disc version where they had the 3 discs with, the first 2 discs were the different cuts of the film, like, all 3 of them, then Disc of Special Features and the soundtrack album. But I think that version's out of print.
Okay.
But, again, there's the 4K restoration coming out this year.
Oh.
Whether or not they're going to do a full re-release and do another set to, like, capitalize on the 50th anniversary. It would make sense.
Is there like a commentary track on there?
So okay. Yeah, there's on the version that I've got, there's a commentary with, if I'm remembering right, it's with film critic Mark Kermode, then with Robin Hardy, Edward Wood, and Christopher Lee.
Oh, really? Oh, see, that'd be kind of fascinating to hear, because I would be very curious to listen to those commentaries. Shout out to Ryan Luis Rodriguez and One Track Mind Podcast, who covers commentaries and films. That would be a great one for you to check out, Ryan, if you're listening to this episode. So, but I'm also curious to listen to that commentary. And I also want to listen to the commentary for the remake of The Wicker Man as well. And just to see how things happen in movies. Because I'm sure when directors are passionate about projects, like, yes, this is great, because this is a movie that hasn't been seen a lot, and I think it'd be great to give it a fresh new look. And I just wanted to see and listen to both commentaries to see how things progress and all that. Who knows? Yeah, I mean, right now the concept of this scene-by-scene podcast, we're at the moment where and I keep forgetting the guy's name. I know the actor Edward Woodward, but I can't remember the character's name.
Howie.
It's like Howie. Because they don't really say his name all that much because he's just our lead character. Howie discovers the photographs of the harvest and everything's going wrong. And he finds out that she may be still alive, but she may be sacrificed.
This is actually a point where there's a difference between the different cuts of the film. Between the director's cut and the final cut. So in the final cut, we see how we find the picture, then thinking about the sacrifice, and then seeing the calendar, and we hear the voiceover of Lord Summerisle talk about the May Day celebrations. In the director's cut, we get some like more explicit dialogue talking about Rowan still being alive, how she's intended to be a sacrifice. And then two actual flashbacks, both to Howie's first interaction with Lord Summerisle, and they're walking through the gardens talking about the pagan rituals, and then to a bit earlier on in this section of the film, we've been talking about the May Day celebrations, and we actually have that footage repeated. And this is an instance where I prefer the final cuts approach, and why I've chosen the final cuts to be the one to discuss it, because I feel like having that extra footage and more explicit flashbacks, for me, it just robs some of the ambiguity and power of the film. We've not really had like flashbacks before. It doesn't quite fit with what the film's going for, having it be the footage repeats rather than just the audio. And I feel like it flows better just having that audio and then cutting into going with Howie back in The Green Man and leading into Willow's Dance.
Yeah, that is very fascinating. Okay, so I'm very curious to check out that 4K code that was released. I'll probably buy the disc, and I most likely will have friends over to watch it on our projection big screen TV, because that would be kind of a cool thing for people that had never seen it before, and I would be very curious to watch this new final cut. I had no idea there was a final cut or director's cut, so I guess you're saying you'd recommend The Founder?
That's the version I personally recommend.
Okay.
So yeah, it's currently planned to be like a full collector's edition being released in September. And if I've got, yeah, I've just looking at the press release from Studio Canal did for it. And it's plans to have all three versions on the 4K release. And
oh, nice.
There's also going to be like a proper 50th anniversary celebration event. At the time of release, it will have already happened. At the time of recording, it's going to be in a few weeks. But on the 1st of May, there's planned to be a full celebration event in London, like presented by Edith Bowman and with guests, Britt Eklund, the associate music director, Gary Carpenter, the family of Robin Hardy, and Reese Shearsmith and Guillermo del Toro.
Oh, nice. Okay.
And it's a shame I don't live in London. I'd love to have gone to see that event. It would have been incredible to see it.
Oh, 100%.
But yeah. Yeah, timings haven't quite worked out, even though it's bank holiday in the UK. And I've also checked this one that's it's completely sold out.
That many people there and all the original cast kind of be involved with it. Yeah, I imagine it'd be a huge thing. I do kind of like, because when I watched the movie and everything, it did kind of remind me a little bit of like the Renaissance Festival. And I'm thinking that, you know, they probably could do like a live recreation of this in the town somewhere.
Yeah, right? I mean, you can't actually, I don't know if you remember it, but a few years ago, there was that Sky Atlantic in the UK, HBO in America series, The Third Day with Jude Law and Catherine Waterston. And one of the things they did as part of that, well, it's kind of like a folk horror type thing, but one of the things they did was a like 12-hour long live event, which was essentially kind of like what you're describing.
Really? Oh, okay. Oh, what's it called?
The Third Day.
Third Date. Okay. All right. News to me. I will definitely look that up later. They're like, all right. Oh, very cool. And like, I know you're going to probably talk about this on another episode, but you mentioned about The Wicker Tree. That was the other sequel to this.
It's kind of like more of a spiritual successor. So it's one where it was like released in 2011, the one directed by Robin Hardy and also written by Hardy. And like, it was one where it was probably originally intended to be more explicit as a sequel to The Wicker Man. Christopher Lee reprises his role as Lord Summerisle, but they make things a bit more vague in the actual release. It's kind of more implied that it's a sequel to The Wicker Man. I don't make abundantly clear that that's what they're going for. It's not a good film. It doesn't capture the magic of the original.
Yeah, I'm looking at the plot summary here, and I'm like, oh, okay. All right, that may be something interested to look at and laugh at, maybe. I'm not quite sure, but I might give it a shot.
And yeah, I think that was intending to be a third one he was intended to do, but it was scuppered following Robin Hardy's death.
And honestly, this works so much better as like kind of a standalone feature.
Yeah.
That you made a point there too, like, if you did do any sequels or a TV series, it would diminish the impact of that ending right there. And I'll be very excited to hear that episode on the ending when that gets released as well.
So, is there any other bits of it you want to talk about for The Wicker Man?
See now, well, I already talked about it before, the scene with Britt Eklund dancing. That was my favorite moment of the movie. I also liked the sequence where everyone's having like the sense orgy out in the backyard. Because there's many times that I went to a festival out, like Renfest and whatnot, and orgies were happening. No, I'm kidding. No, none of this would happen at Renfest, but I wanted it to happen. But nope, that was it.
Okay, then. So that's episode 10 of the Wicker Man podcast. Vern, like to thank you for taking part in this episode.
Well, thank you very much. I haven't done one scene by scene kind of analysis, though. So yeah, that was broke my cherry a little bit for that, and I appreciate that very much. You're very gentle, and I appreciate that. So yeah, that was good.
And do you have anything to plug?
Oh, sure. Thank you very much. Hi, everyone. I'm The Vern. I'm one of the hosts of Cinema Recall Podcast. Me and my best friend, Ashley Rock, we talk about movies, and I know we're going to be doing an episode probably soon. When you hear this, we'll have many episodes out there talk about a feature or a TV show or a song or whatnot. But check us out, cinemarecall.net. We're available on all types of podcast platforms, Spotify, let's see here, Google Podcasts, Audible, Good Pods, YouTube, everywhere. Just, yeah, check us out there. We appreciate it.
Okay, and then for me, you find my main review site over at coosreviews.wordpress.com. Then you can follow me on Twitter at Tony Coons. I'd like to thank Ben again for taking part in this episode.
Thank you.
And to everyone listening, I'll see you all in the next episode.